This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America.
Good evening and welcome to Africa News Tonight from the English to Africa service of the Voice of America, your source for Pan-African news and world developments. I'm Kim Lewis in Washington, and coming up on Africa News Tonight.
A high point of the visit has been the interfaith conference that was arranged by Al-Azhar University. This had been programmed quite a long time ago. The Pope had met with the Imam, the Grand Imam Ahmed Tayyib, in the Vatican back in November.
That's reporter Edward Uranian in Cairo, Egypt, where Pope Francis is visiting today. We'll have full details on the Pope's visit coming up. Also, at least five Nigerian soldiers were reported killed and 40 others injured in a suicide bomb attack in northeast Nigeria. The independent watchdog organization Freedom House releases its Freedom in the World 2017 report, and new research shows that over 75% of girls in South Sudan fail to get a primary school education. We'll have these stories and more. Stay with us on Africa News Tonight. Our top story, at least five Nigerian soldiers were reported killed and 40 others injured in a suicide bomb attack in northeast Nigeria. AFP reports a Boko Haram militant rammed an explosive-laden pickup truck into a tank in northeast Nigeria. The tank was part of a military convoy and was heavily damaged. The convoy was traveling between Yobe and Borno states and was attacked near the village of Manguzum. Pope Francis arrived in Egypt today for a series of meetings with both political and religious leaders. He described his visit as a trip of unity, of fraternity. His first stop was the presidential palace, where he met with Egyptian leader Abdel Fattah el-Sisi. The pontiff's visit is expected to boost the spirits of Coptic Christians following terrorist bombings of two churches on Palm Sunday. Reporter Edward Uranian in Cairo is following Pope Francis' visit and spoke with VOA's Joe DiCapua.
A high point of the visit has been the interfaith conference that was arranged by Al-Azhar University. This had been programmed quite a long time ago. The Pope had met with the Imam, the Grand Imam Ahmed Tayyib, in the Vatican back in November. I believe that's when they originally decided that they were going to hold this meeting. There are religious leaders from various parts of the globe, various religions, the Ecumenical Patriarch of Constantinople, Bartholomew, the Coptic Pope, Tawadros II, Coptic Catholic Pope, Ibrahim Ishaq, also various other religious groups from places like Lebanon and Syria. And they were discussing basically the need for dialogue between the different religions for peace. The Pope said God is peace, that it's incompatible to have violence in the name of God, that God wants us to cooperate and be friends. And the Grand Imam said basically that in this 21st century of human rights and globalization, that we're witnessing an unprecedented barbarity.
What happens on day two of the visit?
Well, the Pope seems to have been restricted in his movements. I guess the security situation is not entirely wonderful, so they clearly don't want him going too far astray. He's been limited to areas around central Cairo in the district where the Papal Nuncio's office is located, also out in a fairly leafy suburb to the south. He's supposed to attend Mass tomorrow. He's supposed to meet head-to-head with Coptic Pope Tawadros this evening, and he's actually leaving tomorrow, I believe, around 5 o'clock, which means he will have been here for just a little over a day. There were initial intentions of staying longer, but I believe that the security situation has prevented that.
That's reporter Edward Uranian in Cairo. He spoke with VOA's Joe DiCapua. The independent watchdog organization Freedom House has released its Freedom in the World 2017 report. It says 2016 marked the 11th consecutive year of a decline in global freedom, citing a rise in populist and nationalist forces in democratic nations. Freedom House says there were setbacks in political rights and civil liberties in countries rated as free in the report, including South Africa and the United States. Eritrea, South Sudan, Sudan, Somalia, Equatorial Guinea, and Central African Republic received very low scores. The worst ratings are given to the Middle East and North Africa, followed closely by Eurasia. Jennifer Dunham is the director of research at Freedom House. She spoke with VOA about the low press freedom ratings given to African nations.
I don't feel like the situation is dire across the continent. I think that it's always a very volatile situation every year. We see countries with declines and countries with improvements. For example, we see countries like Uganda or Kenya or South Africa where the media space is very contested, but there's also a very vibrant media community. There's a lot of reporting going on. There's a lot of really good, aggressive reporting and a lot of press freedom advocacy groups who are doing a good job. And so it's not as if the press is completely repressed or anything like that. So I think while governments, especially in Uganda, are doing a lot to try to crack down on the media, that the press is really doing a really good job to do their job.
Dunham highlighted some of the countries given low marks.
We did see some more declines, especially in the East African countries. Ethiopia is a prime example where a bad situation got worse last year because of the state of emergency and the protests. I think that codified what was already going on in practice. We also saw that in DRC. And in Burundi, we see the ongoing repression of journalists there, and so many journalists have fled into exile. And then Zimbabwe, I think it's pretty much status quo. I think everyone is kind of in a wait-and-see period to see, you know, what's going to happen with Mugabe and the ZANU-PF and his successor.
Jennifer Dunham is the director of research at Freedom House. The organization has released its Freedom in the World 2017 report. Ethiopia's state media report that 7.7 million people in the country now need food aid in drought-affected areas. AFP reports that's about 2 million more than the government's official estimate in January. The hard-hit regions include Oromia, Amhara, and the Southern Nations, Nationalities, and Peoples Region. The National Disaster Risk Management Commission had warned that failed rains would leave 5.6 million people in need of assistance. State media say more than $740 million is needed for drought assistance. Research shows that over 75% of girls in South Sudan failed to get a primary school education. Conflict has fueled a humanitarian crisis and triggered famine in parts of Unity State. The NGO Plan International says both girls and boys are blocked from entering Plan's partner. UNICEF conducted the study in 22 counties. It found that South Sudan has the highest rate of primary school-aged children out of school. Roland Angerer is the regional director for East and Southern Africa for Plan International. He spoke with me about the findings and what's being done to tackle the problem.
As you know, South Sudan is in dire straits as a country, and particularly the girls are suffering from a triple tragedy, which consists of a brutal conflict which has gone on for decades and has revived the last year. Famine has been declared about 2 months ago, so there's a clear food shortage and hunger, and they're also denied their rights to education. And those are the three pillars of development which we think they are deprived of, and that's why we're talking about the triple tragedy.
Research by UNICEF, your partner, finds that 76% of girls in South Sudan are not getting an education. Why are girls hit the hardest, especially during food crises?
You have to see the family traditions and cultures and also the gender discrimination which is built into the society. Girls are often taken out of school earlier than boys, or boys are preferred to be sent to schools because girls are needed in the household to look after siblings, to look for food, and particularly when the crisis hits, that becomes even more important. Secondly, you see girls are exposed in the areas of conflict. Gender-based violence is increasing, and their safety and security when they go to school is in danger. That's the second reason why they often don't go. And thirdly, you see also families who consider the girls just one more mouth to feed at home. And if they have the opportunity to sell them off in marriage by getting a few heads of cattle instead, they actually contribute to the income and to the food security of their own family. The girls are married at very early ages.
What is being done now to help children stay in school in South Sudan? And that would be boys and girls.
Yes, that would be girls and boys, because boys are also affected. Plan International, we are running food for education programs, which is actually give an incentive to families and to children to come to school by giving them meals in school, not only feeding themselves when they come, but also equip them with some food rations that they can take home so that families get the benefit out of it. And that definitely works well because they see there is something in for them. Of course, we also want to give them an education there. So we equip them with school supplies, and we also equip girls with sanitary facilities, because it's often also a drop-out reason that they don't have sanitary facilities or access to dignity kits, as we call them, when they have the periods. We also give them counseling, particularly in areas of internally displaced people who have left their homes due to the conflict. They live in camps, in makeshift camps usually, if they have present violence and they go through traumatic situations. That's the psychosocial help we can give them.
How does education help to overcome the cycle of poverty?
That's a very profound question. I mean, we have to take into account that South Sudan is a country which, even before the conflict, had a literacy rate of around 40%. So that means 60% of the people cannot read and write. At the same time, South Sudan is not a poor country because there is fertile land, there's water, there's mineral resources. But if the population is not educated and prepared to make use of those resources, they will not get the benefits from it. So what we think, if we do not do anything for education now, we'll have another lost generation who will not be able to draw on the resources of their own country. Particularly girls' education, we think, is important because we know from experience and from studies in many other places that providing girls with education actually brings down the birth rate. We also know that over time, educated girls can generate much more income.
What does the international community need to do right now to help in South Sudan?
The humanitarian agencies, including Plan International, are working very hard on the ground and the personal security risk to actually attend to the girls and boys in that country. But we need support. We need really the moral and the financial support. Unfortunately, on the international agenda, South Sudan is dropping on the priority lists. We see the risk that it may disappear in oblivion. Help us by going to different donation webpages or to plan-international.org, where you can find the way to support us.
Roland Angerer is Regional Director for East and Southern Africa for Plan International. He spoke with me from Nairobi. Coming up on 19 Minutes Past the Hour, this is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America. Well, scientists say Africa's Sahel region has some of the most explosive storms on the planet, often causing flooding and disease due to poor sanitation. A new study says climate change has led to the number of extreme storms to triple in the last 35 years. VOA's Joe DiCapua reports.
The Sahel is a semi-arid region, including parts of 10 countries in western and north central Africa. It extends from Senegal to Sudan. The UN says the region is burdened with poverty, rapid population growth, ongoing food crises, and armed conflict and violence. It says this year again, about 30 million people will not have enough to eat. And scientists say climate change is making things even worse by affecting weather. One extreme Sahelian storm in 2009 dumped more than 260 millimeters of rain in just a few hours. Some 150,000 residents in Burkina Faso's capital, Ouagadougou, had to flee their homes. The storms are known as mesoscale convective systems. The study's lead author, Professor Christopher Taylor, explains.
Mesoscale convective systems are big storms which track across the Sahel region of Africa and other parts of Africa. They're like meteorological engines using humidity in the atmosphere for fuel.
Taylor is a meteorologist at the British-based Center for Ecology and Hydrology. He led an international team researching the link between rising global temperatures and storms in the Sahel.
The Sahara Desert has been warming up very rapidly in response to greenhouse gas emissions from around the world, and that's changed the difference in temperature across Africa. And these differences in temperature affect the wind fields, the wind patterns, and in turn that affects the efficiency with which these storms can produce rainfall. And so the warming of the Sahara has made these storms much more intense.
And the frequency of these extreme storms has tripled.
In the early 1980s, we might have seen one of these every 5 days, but now we would see two in every 3 days. So it's a really strong change that we're seeing.
Study co-author Douglas Parker is a professor of meteorology at the University of Leeds.
These storms go very high in the atmosphere, and again, that's what's really special about West Africa. They go up to 16 or 17 kilometers. The deeper they go, the more intense they are, and usually the more rainfall they bring.
Parker says besides being intense, they strike a wide area.
They often feature squall lines. So when these occur, they very often have a line of very heavy rain, and they sweep across with a line that is, you know, maybe several hundred kilometers from north to south. If these are approaching, then they cover a wide swath, and they affect a lot of people.
Parker says average storms in the Sahel have not shown any signs of tripling like the extreme storms. But even the average storms are pretty powerful.
If a storm comes through on market day in a village, it can destroy, you know, all the food for a community. The lightning is extremely hazardous. Lightning will kill cattle, you know, again, which destroys people's livelihoods. It can kill people.
The storms, whether extreme or average, are needed to provide water to grow crops. But Professor Christopher Taylor says too much water can be just as bad as too little.
The rain that's falling is coming much more intensely, so that can erode the soils, and also much of the rain runs off, so it doesn't percolate into the soil, so the crops can't make use of it. So that kind of process is gradually making the rainfall less useful, if you like, for agricultural production.
Taylor says the study will be used to help Ouagadougou adapt to climate change as the city rapidly expands. New living areas are needed, along with infrastructure such as roads and reservoirs. Agriculture will be more resilient if crops planted are better able to withstand storms. Parker says adaptation is vital because scientists say climate change will continue and will make Sahelian storms even more extreme. Joe DiCapua, VOA News, Washington.
The U.S. Senate Foreign Relations Committee discussed this week how to stabilize Libya. Senator Ben Cardin says the U.S. should help Libyan factions reach a new political agreement. Without U.S. participation, he warns that Russia and the Islamic State, ISIS, would seek influence there. Last week, the U.N. Special Envoy to Libya, Martin Kobler, told the Security Council that all Libyan parties had reached an agreement 2 years ago. It included the formation of an interim government and proposed holding elections. Kobler said Libyans themselves may need to amend the deal. Rhiannon Smith is the managing editor of the London-based group Libya Analysis. VOA's Mohammed El-Shenawi asked her how likely opposition factions are to reach a new accord to unite the country.
I think it is doable, provided that there is a delegation from all of the different factions represented. So long as all of the various Libyan interests feel that their views are being represented, I think that is totally doable. I think there will still need to be some international, regional, or external, not so much intervention, but facilitation to ensure that tensions remain calm and to act as a sort of shuttle between some of the different factions. However, I think ultimately this is a Libyan agreement. It's something that the Libyan parties are going to have to adhere to and implement. And therefore, I think having these Libyan voices and Libyan input into the amendment and the final shape of the Libyan political agreement is essential.
But how could Libyan parties reach an agreement while competition for the control of national resources is generating new violence and more divisions?
It will be very difficult. There is no doubt about that. Actually, a lot of the reason behind some of this escalation, particularly in the oil crescent region, is due to this fear that groups don't know who controls the resources. There's no clear power structure. Different factions really feel they have to try and get political leverage by taking physical control and using military force to get some of these resources. Therefore, I think in order for a political agreement to work and for some of these discussions to take place, then there does need to be some ceasefires in place. There needs to be a de-escalation of this conflict and violence on the understanding that the negotiations will then hopefully produce an agreement that all parties can adhere to.
So what kind of confidence-building measures are needed to lower the level of mistrust among Libyan factions?
I think a big one that's quite important that often gets overlooked in these discussions where we talk about, you know, the conflict and the violence and also the political division is the economic aspect. So Libya's economy currently is in a very dire situation. The dinar has plummeted. There's lots of issues going on with the Central Bank of Libya that different factions want control over. So I think if there was some kind of basic economic agreement going on that could be agreed as to how some of the, particularly the oil resources and the Central Bank of Libya, the National Oil Corporation, these key financial institutions, how they operate, how they distribute the money and budgets, I think that would be a very key stepping point as a confidence building. The other one, I think, is that although the international community and various regional actors and the UN, other Western countries are involved in Libya and many are supporting the LPA and discussions, it's not always a unified front, and there are still particular nations that are giving funding or arming or, you know, giving other kind of political support to specific factions. And I think that makes then other rival factions, militias, political parties quite nervous. So I think if there was a way to really show a united front on the international side, I think this would also help build confidence and would stop some of, sort of the backhand dealing that we've seen with these different rival factions. And that's really, I think, the responsibility of the international community to do rather than necessarily the Libyan actors.
That was Rhiannon Smith, the managing editor of the London-based group Libya Analysis. She was speaking with VOA's Mohammed El-Shenawy. And that wraps up this edition of Africa News Tonight. I'm Kim Lewis in Washington. For all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at voaafrica.com. Please stay tuned to the Sunny Side of Sports coming up at 18:30 UTC. On behalf of our producer, Bill Workinger, and our engineer, Curtis Bynum, thanks for choosing the Voice of America.
Hello, this is Heather Maxwell, host of Music Time in Africa. Question, on what other radio program can you listen to Africa's hottest bangers and oldies in one smoking hour? Answer, none. Only Voice of America's Music Time in Africa gives you that. This week, I bring you the best music from the continent. Daddy, don't be mad. From Malawi to Mali, from Cameroon to Cote d'Ivoire. So tune in this Sunday, peeps, 1500 and 2000 UTC on your VOA Africa's FM station.
When news breaks, VOA Africa is there. VOA. On weekends, tune into Nightline Africa at 1600 and 1800 UTC. And our five-minute newscasts come to you at the top of each hour. VOA Africa, your trusted source of information.